Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity of National Review is back from the NRA convention. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And Jim, welcome back. It's good to have you back, and I'm sure you are more pumped up than ever to defend the Second Amendment.
Yeah. Okay, can be perfectly honest. No. In the sense that this is the first – my first one was Charlotte in 2010. This is the first NRA convention where there hasn't been, you have to stop Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. Now it's like Chuck Schumer and the 48 senators and the unlikeliness of them expanding their majority. And oh, by the way – Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, look, either he's running against Bill Nelson next year or he is the world's biggest tease because, man, you don't go to Atlanta outside of your state. He did make a pitch for how wonderful Florida is and how everybody should come visit. But he, in the middle of it, he starts talking about how terrible Bill Nelson is on judges and the importance of appointing judges like Neil Gorsuch, who will support the second and preserve the Second Amendment. Gee, why would that be on your mind, Rick? So look, you know, he didn't quite come out and say he's running, but I took it as a strong indicator, which struck me as real political news coming out of the conference.
Also, Jim, we should point out today is May Day. So socialists and communists and liberals who like to identify with those things are going to be marching today. We should probably point out that there will be more people marching if tens of millions had not been killed by communists around the world for the last few generations. So good luck with your protest today, everybody.
That's a pretty bad burn, almost as bad as the burning of their eyes and noses from the pollen that will be out at the beginning of May. Good timing, guys.
All right, let's move on to the good martini now, and let's start with Elizabeth Warren. Boy, that doesn't happen too often. But nonetheless, Elizabeth Warren is in our good martini today. She is becoming increasingly critical of Democrats in general, but specifically Barack Obama, which up until pretty much now has been off limits by Democrats to criticize. She did an interview with The Guardian. She's got this new book out called This Fight is Our Fight. And of course, she's rumored to be running in 2020. But here's what she said about Obama, who she also criticized for taking the $400,000 last week for the Wall Street speech. Quote, I think President Obama, like many others in both parties, talks about a big set of national statistics that look shiny and great, but increasingly have giant blind spots that GDP, unemployment no longer reflect the lived experiences of most Americans, and the lived experiences of most Americans are that they're being left behind in this economy, Warren said. Worse than being left behind, they are being kicked in the teeth. And she also disagreed with Bernie Sanders that you can actually support a pro-life Democrat. So she's driving the party even further to the left than Barack Obama was doing it. Jim, the Obama coalition is something every Democratic presidential candidate would want to reassemble. No one else has been able to do that. So what do you make of Barack Obama now being fair game from the left?
The first thing is that this, you know, the phrase kicked in the teeth may be the single most important comment we've heard from any Democrat since Election Day 2016. And by that, I mean, there's been this, you know, why did we lose? Was it Russia? Was it the FBI? Was it Hillary's weakness? This comes on the context of a new poll and survey and focus group being done by Priorities USA. It's a Democratic super PAC. And it looked at two groups of voters, people who voted for Obama twice and then voted for Trump, and looked for people who had traditionally voted Democrat and did not vote in 2016. They did focus groups in Wisconsin and Michigan. And the most ominous result of this study and these focus groups from the perspective of the Democrats is these groups are convinced Democrats support the rich. These groups are convinced that Donald Trump will at least do something for them, particularly on immigration and issues like that, and that the Democrats won't. And for Democrats, this is a slap in the face. This is like, you know, this is something they always thought they had. We've seen in the last couple of weeks this emerging divide amongst the Democrats of are they fundamentally – Bernie Sanders wants them to be a class warfare party. And you might say, okay, they've always been that way. But as seen in that fight over the mayor running in Omaha, wherever it was, he's okay with a pro-life Democrat as long as they are on board with this broad agenda of the rich are out to get you. The rich are out to screw you. The reason you're not, your life isn't going the way you want it to is these bad rich people. And the purpose of government is to take stuff from the rich people and give it to you. Now, you and I would argue against that, but we at least could acknowledge it's pretty darn popular. And there was more than a little bit of a vibe of that coming off from Trump's campaign in 2016. For a lot of Democrats, no. It's not so much about that as identity politics, right? We are the elite. We are the enlightened. We are here to tell you what your bathroom policy should be. We are here to tell you that you can't have those thoughts and that we need to ban those kinds of speakers from college campuses or entirely from society at all. We are all about Black Lives Matter. We are all about gay rights. It's all about your identity and your role of building a more tolerant, diverse society, et cetera, et cetera. These are two very different viewpoints. Warren tries to straddle it, but in this comment, she basically comes out and says, you know what? The economy during the Obama years wasn't that good. And that's something, you know, longtime listeners of the Three Martini Lunch will say, yeah, you and I have been saying that for quite a while. And it's worth saying, hey, you know what? Yes, the economy, the unemployment rate went down nationally. Maybe if you're doing really well, if you live in Texas or Louisiana or North Dakota with the fracking boom, certain parts of the country are doing quite well. I think up in Wisconsin, it's at less than 4% now. There are other parts of the country that are doing particularly badly, and particularly if you're in these small towns in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania and Michigan and places like that. So I think Warren makes a legitimate objection here that it's fair to ask whether economic statistics really capture how the economy is doing for, if not all Americans, and for enough Americans to give us an accurate picture. Then the second thing is, once you're a Democrat and mark the date, May 1st, 2017, it is now okay for Democrats to discuss the Obama legacy and to kind of acknowledge that things didn't turn out the way they wanted to. It is natural and instinctive that they're going to have this. No, our president's doing great because they voted for the guy. No one wants to admit that their guy screwed up or didn't perform the way they were supposed to. Now that enough time has passed, the afterglow or the shining vibe that Democrats wanted to have. Look, now they can admit it. A lot of Americans feel like they didn't get ahead. Even if they had a job, the new job didn't pay as much as the old one. They're paying more for health insurance. The cost of living is going up. They feel like they're losing ground. And first of all, for the general country, I think it's good to have two parties looking at the situation seriously instead of remaining in this partisan denial. And then secondly, I don't think this will be the last word on it, though. I think the Obama folks are going to come out guns blazing, metaphorically, at Elizabeth Warren. And I think there could be a lot of big, interesting fights going on the Democratic Party side over the next couple of months. How willing are they to admit that the Obama approach to the economy didn't work? And, are they likely to turn to a much more radical proposal in the Bernie Sanders style?
All right, let's move on to the bad martini now. Boy, that Democratic Party, that thing's a mess. It's a good thing the Republicans have their own issues. Byron York reporting towards the end of last week with the just depressing title, "Why Can't the House Repeal Obamacare? Because a lot of Republicans don't want to." On March 24th, when the Speaker pulled the GOP Obamacare bill before what would have been a sure defeat, he said, "We're going to be living with Obamacare for the foreseeable future." But why? Republicans have 238 seats in the House. Repealing Obamacare will require 217 votes. Even with unanimous Democratic opposition, Republicans could lose 21 votes and still prevail on repeal. Why haven't they done it? By this time, it's becoming increasingly clear that Republicans have not repealed Obamacare because a lot of Republicans do not want to repeal Obamacare. They don't even want to sort of repeal Obamacare. The bill currently on the table, like the bill pulled in March, falls far short of a full repeal of Obamacare, and yet Republicans still cannot agree on it. About a week after the first Obamacare repeal failure, a House Republican, speaking privately, said the difficulty in passing the bill was not a parliamentary problem involving the complexities of the Senate and reconciliation. No, the lawmaker said, it is a problem that we have members in the Republican conference that do not want Obamacare repealed because of their district. That's the fundamental thing that we're seeing here. Quote, "I thought we campaigned on repealing it. Now that it's our turn, I'm finding there's about 50 people who really don't want to repeal Obamacare. They want to keep it." It even goes down to talk about how they're squeamish about letting states have more flexibility in what constitutes a plan in those states. So, Jim, I don't even know what question to ask here, but I guess this is why we can't have nice things.
This is kind of a consequence of Republicans not being honest with themselves and not being honest with the public, their primary voters, their general election voters, about the healthcare issue.
There are a couple of different reasons that Republicans might be wary about repealing Obamacare. But probably the biggest and clearest, most glaring one is we expanded Medicaid. That added about 10 to 11 million people on the rolls. And if you repeal all of Obamacare, you take that away from them. And they get very upset. And they get very angry. And these are people who are generally, you know, because of the expansion, they're not extremely poor. They're somewhat less extremely poor, but I think in most people's eyes would qualify as still pretty darn poor. Thus, the headline is Republicans taking away health insurance from poor people. It's a bad headline, could hurt them in 2018. And it's, you know, unlike most Democratic criticisms, it would have the advantage of being true. Lots of Republicans like Scott Walker want to do, at the very least, you got to do this with states giving them enormous flexibility for them to gradually create ways to get these people onto private insurance plans. If Republicans were, but that wasn't the sort of, you know, talk you saw on the campaign trail last time, Greg. I'm sure we could hear lots of Republicans, you know, we're going to repeal every last word of Obamacare, and we're going to do it day one. Look, there are some parts where you hear Obamacare is failing. Well, the individual market is failing and failing quickly. That's where the death spiral is. The expansion of Medicaid is pretty darn popular. People like getting their, you know, health insurance covered by the government. We can argue about whether it's it's a cost effective. We can argue about whether it's better, actually improves people's health. We can argue about whether this is, you know, fiscally responsible, because the costs of programs like this tend to grow up really fast, really, really quickly and really, you know, intensely. It's, you know, but having, you know, this is why we don't like to expand entitlements, because once you expand them, it's just about difficult to repeal them. People don't like having stuff taken away from them. And if Republicans could be more honest with themselves and with each other, they could at least say, you know what, we're not going to repeal every last bit of Obamacare. We're going to repeal the parts that people really hate. And to me, that strikes me as a wiser political stance. I think it's a wiser policy choice. You know, part of the problem that created so many problems of Obamacare was the idea that Democrats believed the entire healthcare issue had to be resolved in one fell swoop with one giant bill that most of them did not bother to read. That's not good lawmaking. That is not a good way to address an extraordinarily complicated system of 1/6 of the economy. If it were up to me, you'd say, you know what, we're going after the mandate because people don't like the mandate. We'll get rid of the medical device tax because people don't like that. And we will go after the different costs that are increasing, driving up premiums and things like that. Do what you can and do it piece by piece rather than attempting to do it in one grand ceremony, bill signing ceremony that you claim will fix healthcare forever, because there will be people who will walk away from a Republican healthcare reform bill disappointed with what they got. It's just a matter of reality.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a really depressing martini.
Extremely.
Glad I could cheer everybody on Monday. They're probably saying, "Why can't Jim go away again?"
Jim, let's move now to the crazy martini now, and this is also from the pages of the Washington Examiner. I think a lot of people in conservative circles were pretty surprised to see the news on Friday that Jim DeMint, the former South Carolina congressman, then senator, then Heritage Foundation president, was out as president of the Heritage Foundation. Some of the immediate speculation suggested, well, before DeMint got there, it was more policy and research oriented. It got more political during the DeMint years. But now some of the rumors floating out there suggest that if politics was the problem, the direction that some people might think it's going here would make this an even more curious move. Will blistering populist Steve Bannon replace fiery conservative Senator Jim DeMint as the next president of the Heritage Foundation? Heritage Action CEO Michael Needham won't say. Asked by Chris Wallace whether Heritage would be Bannon's, quote, safety net as he's forced out of the White House, unquote, Needham demurred on Fox News Sunday, quote, I can tell you, Needham replied, there's a lot of speculation in the room and in the media that never misses a chance to divide and attack conservatives. With that non-answer, speculation over the fate of Heritage Foundation will no doubt reach a new fever pitch. News of DeMint's ouster has already sent shockwaves throughout the think tank and reverberations through right-wing circles in Washington, D.C. The original president of Heritage, Ed Fulner, is the interim president. And the article also points out that Bannon has a close relationship with Heritage board member Rebecca Mercer, who, of course, is the Mercers are pretty big on funding and steering the Breitbart site that Bannon led for a number of years. So, Jim, obviously we don't want to assume this is true. It's mainly speculation. But the fact that a rock-ribbed conservative like DeMint, whether you like the way he ran the Heritage Foundation or not, is out, and this might be the way the Heritage Foundation could be headed is kind of stunning.
I want to turn the clock back to 2013, Greg, because, you know, I tried not to be excessively vocal about it, but you heard some grumbling in conservative circles when Senator Jim DeMint, who up until that point had been really one of the stalwart leaders of conservatism, a guy who was willing to stand for principle even when he alienated the leadership of the Republican Party. He had promised, I believe at one point said, I'd rather have 30 true conservatives than 70 Republicans if a bunch of them are squishes. And a bunch of Republicans are like, are you sure about that? Because, you know, easier to persuade a Republican squish than to have a Democrat. Just, you know, just saying. But DeMint left, and he left fairly shortly after Obama's reelection, when conservatives were really feeling bummed and down and wondering if they really had lost the country and if we were even still a center-right country anymore. And all of a sudden, one of the guys you could really count on in the Senate says, hey, you know what? I'm out of here. I'm off to head up the Heritage Foundation. Now, the Heritage Foundation is a fantastic organization. They've been kind enough to have me go over there and speak us up a couple times. Really the preeminent conservative think tank in Washington, although I'm sure, you know, somewhere Jonah and Ramesh from the American Enterprise Institute are grumbling that I'm saying this. But, you know, indisputably a major iconic force in the conservative movement.
Right.
By the way, Ed Fulner has said, I believe Ed Fulner made at least $1 million a year. This is a fairly lucrative position to be heading up the Heritage Foundation. DeMint is there. I think you can say that it has become a slightly more political, slightly more strident think tank, but still mostly doing its bread and butter of conservative policy research and ideas and coming up with proposals and white papers and things like that. So the idea of losing Jim DeMint to go there and then to see him depart about 4 years later has me scratching my head wondering if all of that was worth it. Now, people would point out that because of Jim DeMint's retirement, we ended up getting Tim Scott appointed and then fully elected as senator of South Carolina. And basically, I'm not saying he walks on water down in South Carolina. I'm just saying that Tim Scott, when he steps into the water, he doesn't go down all the way to the bottom. He's just kind of, you know, he floats, basically. He's a really beloved and I think extremely solid conservative senator. So you could argue from that perspective, this was not a bad trade. If this really is the departure of Jim DeMint, I get to kind of wonder if this was all worth it and why this change was, particularly with Fulner coming back. Big question will be who replaces him. And Greg, I'll just say, if you're thinking of putting Steve Bannon in charge, please talk to some of his employees, or I should say ex-employees at Breitbart. Please talk to people what kind of a manager he is and how he treats people and things like that, because I think it would be – the anecdotes would be eye-opening if they could get past the non-disclosure agreements that are mandatory. I'll just tell you that there are plenty of people who would say he was far from an ideal boss. And in fact – I mean, look, ask yourself whether Breitbart was better off on whether it was under Andrew Breitbart or whether it was under Steve Bannon. I'll just leave it there.
Quite a start to the week, Jim.
Yeah, and it's only Monday. Well, yeah. The good news is it's a short week, right, Greg?
No.
Ah! See you for 4 more days, everybody.
Sadly not. Jim, good to have you back. Talk to you tomorrow. Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.